Hey, MJ, you know what's cool?
What's cool?
Listening to Casual Wednesdays. You know what's even cooler than that?
What's cooler than that?
Having friends.
Okay.
And you know what's even cooler than that?
What?
Having friends so you can tell them about Casual Wednesdays.
Ah,
yeah, see what I'm
doing
there? I see
where you were going.
That's right.
Though.
So if you've got a friend and they don't know about Casual Wednesdays yet, spread the word. Spread it.
That sounded like a threat.
Oh, I didn't mean it as such. I'm sorry. Hello, everyone. You're listening to Casual Wednesdays with Doom Rocket. I'm Jared Jones. Across the table from me is MJ Kramer. Every week, we talk about comics, or at least we try to. This week, it's been a long time coming. Far too long for some.
For me.
Not near long enough for others.
For you.
Yeah, I know. But we finally returned with the latest installment of our famed Sandman read-throughs. So grab a nice beverage and squid yourself into a cozy position as MJ and I dig into Book 7 of Neil Gaiman's venerated Sandman series, Brief Lives. What does this chapter in DC's perennial reprint money machine tell us about the endless, the dreaming, and big old mopey mope himself, Morpheus? Things! High-minded, scholarly things! Also this week, we'll tackle our top 5 during this most flimsy of new comic book days, answer a listener question, and tease the next 3 weeks' worth of our lives in the back matter. What could it all mean? I guess we'll find out in about an hour? Maybe be patient? I don't know. Figure it's time for Casual Wednesdays. Hello, everyone. Hey, MJ.
Hi, Jared.
How are you doing?
I'm pretty good.
Yeah, yeah. How's your week?
Well, you just mentioned how it's a very sparse new comic book day.
It is. It is.
There's no DC because this is the skip week between when the diamond shipments from them ended and the new shipments from either Lunar or UCS start.
Ugh, what a mess.
Yeah.
What's Marvel's excuse?
Well, they've been doing every other week is single issues and then every other week is paperbacks and such.
I see. I see. But there's nothing coming out.
There were like two Marvel collections that came out. There was Excalibur Volume 1 and...
Oh, that's right.
Something else that I don't remember.
Was it by any chance a Marvel Masterwork?
It might have been.
An Amazing Spider-Man Marvel Masterwork, to be exact?
Yes.
Who buys those?
Collectors. Collectors like to get the whole series, the whole set.
I feel like the design, the trade dress design for those hardcovers hasn't been changed since like 1993.
Well, I think a lot of those OG collectors like that that whole collection they've got has the same trade dress.
They better like it. Those things cost like $100 a pop.
I know, but enough about my week. What about yours?
My week? Busy.
Busy with what?
Busy with Doom Rocket, if I may.
Oh.
That's right. Both myself and the team at DoomRocket.com were hard at work making things that people can read as opposed to listen to. And amongst those things, I had not one, not two, but three interviews. One with Rob Williams concerning his new Judge Dredd series called End of Days. It's wild stuff. He even teases some crazy stuff about his career with 2000 AD and where it may land at the end of the story. So head over to Doom Rocket, check that out. Talk to Alex DeCampi about her 2000 AD strip
called
Full Tilt Boogie, which is the first Regine strip to graduate to the adult 2000 AD book.
Oh.
That's right. And then finally, I spoke with Elliot Rahal concerning his new Vault Comics book, Bleed Them Dry, an awesome book that we've been pushing on this podcast. And I gotta say, talking to him made me even more excited for this project, if that's possible.
Hmm.
So on top of all of that, if you feel like heading over to Doom Rocket right now, you can while you're listening to this podcast. It's kind of meta, as the kids say. You can look forward to our best covers of the month feature, Undercover, that headlines, with an advanced review of Eat and Love Yourself from Sweeney Boo and Boom Studios. That's written by contributor Lauren Fernandez. Then we have a review written by Clyde Hall about Bleed Them Dry. And then, of course, we have the latest required reading feature by Arpad OK, which features We Serve the People.
That's from Boom, right?
The Archaea imprint, to be exact. And then after that, all sorts of other good stuff. I know, Cooper, it's incredible how thorough we are over at Doom Rocket, considering we only post new content once a month. But yes, very busy week. It was a lot of fun. Go check it out, DoomRocket.com. But MJ, before we get into the topic of the week, which is Sandman Brief Lives, we should probably bring up the fact that we didn't announce our contest winner last week. Oh my God, we were so busy.
Yeah, we forgot. It slipped our minds. Sorry.
Not only did we forget to announce the winner, we also forgot to let people know that we had a contest going at all last week. I feel like such a failure as a podcaster.
We were very focused on our solicitations, that's all.
That's true. You know what I also found out last week?
What?
You can hear our fans.
I was wondering about that. I asked about that before.
Yeah. We live in Chicago, and that means you pay an ass fuck load of money to live in a place without central air. So we don't have central air. It's really hot in our apartment, and so we had our fans blowing, and if you can hear them this week, I'm sorry.
It's either that or we just sweat, and that would not make for good podcasting.
Yeah, WBEZ isn't inviting us over to record at their studio. So.
Yeah, yeah.
Until then, yeah, this is what you guys have to deal with. But back to the contest stuff really quick. You guys know all about it. All you have to do is go over to Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. We don't care which. Leave a 5-star review. That's right, Cooper. Say something nice and or constructive. We put you in the drawing. And once you're in for the year, the entire year.
Unless you win.
Unless you win, or we run out of comics to give, whichever right. come first. And this month, or last month rather, our winner was from Apple Podcasts, Cooper, trying to get work done.
See, the best thing is that he's sitting right next to the fan, meowing into the fan, so it's like making his voice do that weird warbly thing.
Yeah, yeah. He's like Chris Farley and Tommy Boy.
Yes.
Yeah. So the winner from Apple Podcasts is user RDDJ623, who wrote us a wonderful 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. MJ, can I share that review with you now?
Well, yes.
All right. RDDJ623 wrote, Fireside Chats for Comics Fans. Quote, Jared and MJ make you feel like you're old chums hanging out and talking comics. They make their in-depth knowledge accessible and fun for everyone from other uber nerds to total newbies. I always appreciate their candor and recommendations. They're also quote-unquote goals, as the kids say these days. Give the podcast a listen. You won't regret it. End quote.
I don't know about being goals.
We're just people, man.
Yeah.
And he's just a cat.
Oh, he's so loud.
Cooper, what is it with you? Did you get your Friskies today? It doesn't matter. Anyway, congratulations, RDDJ623. All you got to do is head over to Twitter, DM me, DM MJ, DM Doom Rocket, or Casual Wednesdays over at Casueds Podcast on Twitter. Nudge, nudge. Send us your address. We want to send you comics. You won The Wicked and Divine, volumes 1-3. And now they need a home. And we'll throw in some Doom Rocket stickers as a way of saying thanks.
Of course, of course.
And finally, one last bit of Doom Rocket business before we get into the news this week, MJ. I wanted to mention that we have a new giveaway this month, and it's even bigger than the one before. It's not really much bigger, but it's kind of big.
What is it?
This month, we are giving away books 1, 2, and 3 of Superman Smashes the Clan by Gene Luen Yang and studio artists Guri Hiro, published by DC Comics this year. That's right, Coop. You can't believe it. It's one of the best comics DC's published this year, and it can be yours. Just head over to Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. We don't care which. Leave us the review. You know what to do, and the comic could be yours.
It's truly one of those comics that is all ages. It is suitable for kids, but also perfectly suitable for people our age.
There are a lot of people our age that could use the message in that book, I don't mind saying.
Yes.
Don't mind saying out loud. All right, MJ, are you ready for the news this week?
I'm ready. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
How about some Harley Quinn news?
I guess.
Well, this is news from DC Comics. Mm-hmm. They had previously announced that they were doing a new digital-first Harley Quinn comic called Harley Quinn Black and White and Red.
And that's right. And the reason we didn't promote it on Twitter was because we're not pushing books that are digital-first. We want to support the retailers. You keeping it from retailers? We're keeping it from our listeners here.
Yeah, we are. We're pro direct market in this house.
That's right. But why are we bringing it up now, MJ?
Well, DC has announced that this will be available in print at a later date.
I don't know why I'm surprised. They do this with all their digital first. Yeah. Ultimately, eventually, anyway.
Yeah, it's just funny that they did say that it was going to be available in a print version, but they have not said in what format or when. It's going to come out. They just said, yeah, we'll put that in print.
They're reassuring retailers who are grousing. It's like brand new Harley Quinn content, digital first. Are you fucking kidding me?
The first story is going to be by Stepan Sejic. It's going to be Harleen Red, which is cool.
Stepan Sejic, who is leaving DC and presumably the big two for the rest of his life, as he has said a couple of times on social media, after his Harleen run is over.
Yeah, this might be that final Harleen bit.
Could be.
So we'll find out. We'll find out.
Could be. Do we have any information about this yet?
Nope.
Oh, boy.
Nope.
Okay, so we know that it exists.
Will exist.
That's right. It's kind of a slow comic book week.
Yeah. But I do want to mention that future chapters will feature Paul Dini, the team of Amanda Connor, Jimmy Palmiotti, and Chad Harden, who did a very celebrated Harley Quinn run.
Yeah, that's not surprising.
And the pairing of Saladin Ahmed and Javier Rodriguez. That is awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that Saladin Ahmed's first DC work, or has he done some other like little short stories?
Oh, you're putting me on the spot, MJ. I couldn't say offhand.
Okay. I don't know, so I didn't want to postulate one way or the other.
Sure, sure, sure.
But Javier Rodriguez, that's some delicious art right there.
Awesome possum. MJ, what's next for news?
Well, next we've got an item announced that you are not going to want me to buy, and that I am going to be very, very tempted to buy.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. real quick, this is about Jack Kirby. MJ just brought home yet another gigantic fucking book we don't have any space for in this house.
We do too have space for it. We have space on the absolute shelf.
No, because that's where you put all your damn Star Wars Force Awakens figures.
You
where
put
we're
them
supposed
there.
To move them.
You put them there.
Because there's
can
nowhere
take
else for
down.
Them to go.
I can take those down.
Man. You guys just got a window into how our life actually is when the mics are off.
I can make room for my brand new, fancy, beautiful, absolute hardcover of Jack Kirby's The Fourth World, Volume 1.
Well, I guess we have to. It's here now.
Well, yeah, yeah.
All right, so you brought it up. What other book am I going to advise you to not buy?
All right, so you know how Marvel's been putting out a bunch of Eternals stuff since that Eternals movie's coming out soon?
Allegedly coming out.
Well, yeah, with movies nowadays, Who the hell knows? They are going to be publishing Kirby's The Eternals in their monster size format. Now, I already have a few of Marvel's monster size hardcovers.
Yes, you do.
They're fantastic. This is going to be really cool.
You got any details on this book?
The oversized 384-page book will have a trim size of just over 13 inches by 21 inches and features a cover by Jack Kirby. And supposedly it will be available in January of 2021 for $125. I mean, it's 19 comics.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of stuff in there.
How much did that Kirby Absolute Edition run you, out of curiosity?
I'm not sure what the MSRP was for it.
You know I can look it up.
You can, but I paid well under that because employee discount, remember?
I see.
But this one, like I said, it's going to be $125. It's so funny. The very first one of these enormous hardcovers Marvel put out was that Fantastic Four one, that cool-ass Alex Ross cover.
Yeah.
The Behold Galactus one. And that one was only like $50 the first time they put it out, and it sold so quick, that first printing of it, that Marvel was like, we are undercharging. Everybody wants this.
We left money on the goddamn table.
Double the price.
I was holding an imaginary cigar as I said it, as I presume everybody head honchos that work at Marvel do.
Probably Ike Perlmutter is doing that right now. Just
with an actual imaginary cigar, because he's old. He shouldn't be smoking cigars.
Yeah.
He also sucks, by the way. Okay.
He should be smoking cigars.
I don't.
But this is just one of many other Eternals items that they are printing, like I mentioned. They're going to be putting out a new version of the Neil Gaiman Romita Jr. series.
I read that.
God, when did that come out?
I would say that came out in 99, 2000. No.
No,
I think
it was a little later.
Yeah, it came out like 2003, 2004.
Yeah.
I caught myself being older than I actually was.
Well, I know it was around then because that was being printed in single issues when I had started buying single issue comics, so it would have been around then.
All right.
Yeah.
Anything else?
Not about that Eternals hardcover.
Oh, I see. So what's next for news?
So you might have heard that there were some weird things going on with the Eisner Award voting this year.
That's right.
People had reported that they had voted and gone back to double check their votes and that they had been changed.
What? Well, it didn't happen to me that I'm aware of. I haven't actually double-checked yet.
Ruh-roh, maybe
but
you should.
I heard it happen to a lot of people.
Yeah, and so the problems got reported to the organizers, and they looked into it, started an investigation, and they recently said in a statement, the organizers did, that, quote, as a result of our investigation into the recently reported issues with the Eisner Awards voting website, it appears this was not a malicious attempt, but an error in the platform itself. While our examination of the records leads us to believe the problem is small, and we have no direct evidence that any votes have been altered, out of an abundance of caution and care, we have decided to rerun the vote with a current and secure voting platform, unquote.
I mean, if you've ever voted for the Eisners, the second you click over to the ballot form, something's awry. Like, they're using Comic Sans, for Christ's sake.
Yes, they're using Comic Sans. It's an old website. You can tell. Yeah. They haven't changed this in a very long time.
So that ballot looks rather tantalizing to potential hackers. Not to say the hackers actually did it or had anything to do with it, but it's very vulnerable, and I'm supposing that it won't be anymore?
I guess so. They said that the voters are going to be notified to vote on a new platform, but I mean, I'm an Eisner voter and you're an Eisner voter.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't received any kind of notification.
Nor have I. No. Yeah.
So, who knows what's going on? Where people are going to vote at?
Maybe they ran an internal audit and found our names on there and went, what the hell are these Doom Rocket kids doing
just
there?
Just deleted them?
Running their mouths about us for years.
Well, I'm not in there as a Doom Rocket employee. I'm in there as a retailer.
I see.
Yeah, I've got like double cred, you know.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you're so cool.
And I have creator cred too.
That's true.
Actually, so do you, don't you?
I guess that's technically true.
You could add that to your little resume within their voting form. But usually they announce the winners of the Eisners at San Diego Comic-Con, as you probably know. But San Diego Comic-Con isn't happening this year.
That's right.
So it's entirely plausible that they could just delay the Eisner Awards.
That would make a lot of Eisner nominees very sad.
I don't think they would care, as because it would mean that they're fixing the votes and making sure that all the votes are counted and are voted upon correctly. So I think people, everybody, would probably rather have it be delayed than have everybody be in kind of this flux where who knows when we're voting, what we're voting on.
Yeah.
I hope that they delay it. I mean, like I said, it doesn't really matter. There's no San Diego Comic-Con. So
I mean, it matters. When you win an Eisner, that matters. It doesn't matter if there's a stage where you accept it or not.
True, true. But I just mean there's not like a ceremony to have to bump. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I see what you mean.
Although I think we were talking about this before. I really do hope that they still do some sort of like a Zoom pseudo ceremony for the Eisners. It would be very cute.
Oh, what a nightmare that would be.
But people would actually be able to watch it in that case. Because they've never really, you know, no form of having it televised before.
That sucks because they broadcast all that Hall H shit. So yeah. Why can't they broadcast the Eisners?
Yeah, I'm so sick of having to follow someone live tweeting it to find out who's winning things and to find out who's saying what funny thing in their acceptance speech and what John Barrowman's dressed as.
Usually a chicken. You know.
But that's all I've got for news, Jared, unless you've got something you want to mention.
Really quick, I'd like to acknowledge that Joe Sinnott, Master Inker, has passed away this week.
Oh.
That's right. It was very sad. He was 93.
That's a good run.
That's a damn good run. In fact, I found out that he had still been inking the Amazing Spider-Man newspaper strip all the way up to last year.
Wow.
Started off with Fantastic Four number 5 over Jack Kirby. Went on to continue to ink over Jack Kirby, starting again with Fantastic Four number 44, and stayed with Kirby all the way to issue number 102.
Dang.
Yeah.
That's some good stuff.
Casual Wednesday salutes you, Joe.
Rest in peace, sir.
That's right. All right, MJ, no more news.
No more news.
All right, topic of the week.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Brief Lives, Sandman, book 7.
Yes.
We're finally here.
Yes. We haven't done one of these since April 15th.
It's been a while.
It's been a long time.
Yeah.
Now, Jared didn't love Fables and Reflections so much.
It was my least favorite book out of all of Sandman so far, largely because the collected stories, they're fine on their own, but I was wondering what the hell the point was. I guess I would have liked it more, and I said this in the last Sandman episode, I would have liked it more had I read it month by month, as opposed to trade by trade, mm-hmm. and then having to wait a month to read the next trade.
Now, Brief Lives, I knew you were going to like more.
Mm-hmm. And this is for people who haven't listened to our Sandman read-throughs before. I've never read Sandman before. This is my first time through.
Jared's the newbie, and then this was what got me into comics in general. It's funny, we were talking about that Eternals miniseries that Neil Gaiman wrote. The reason that I started reading that when it was in single-issue form is because I had very recently read Sandman and decided, oh, I like this medium.
Yep.
Yep.
It was all downhill from there.
Yes. And this volume, Brief Lives, is my very favorite volume.
This is your favorite?
It's my favorite volume.
Out of all of them?
Yes.
Really? Why?
I love what it says. I love how it flows. I love where it goes. I love that it is very much the linchpin of the series. At this point is where kind of the inevitable begins.
No spoilers, huh?
I wouldn't say that's spoilers. All right. But it's definitely a turning point in the whole series. And another huge reason I love this book is because of the art. Now, this art is by Jill Thompson, inked by Vince Locke, with colors by Danny Fazzo.
For the entire book.
For the entire book. This is the first and only Sandman volume that has one single consistent art team.
And it really helps the story.
Yeah.
It helps it a lot. Although I think Dick Giordano might have pinch hit for one issue.
Yes, yes. So right. we had one inker fill-in.
Mm-hmm.
But all in all, that's a lot better than having like a whole issue or two completely drawn by someone else.
I completely agree. In fact, having Jill and Vince and Todd be the sole creative team on this book not only helped me get my bearings again after Fables and Reflections, it made me love this story again. I really did enjoy this. In fact, this might be my most favorite of them all so far.
Really?
Yeah, that's right.
Even more than Season of Mists? You love Season of Mists.
I know. It's tough. It's tough. I've been thinking about it a lot this week. I think Season of Mists still holds it out just because I like the imagery of it. And Kelly Jones did some of his best work in Season of Mists. And Kelly Jones is one of my favorite artists, but so is Jill.
And this is when she was still relatively a newbie in the industry. She had been working on Wonder Woman before this. And apparently Neil Gaiman was shown this like nude drawing of death that she had done in like at San Diego Comic-Con in like 1990.
Easy.
And Neil was like, wow, this was really good. And he ended up meeting her at that con and was like, hey, would you ever want to do Sandman? And she was like, yes. So they ended up kind of rearranging some stuff and moving her over to Sandman. The wheels of comics move very slowly. So yeah, it was like a year before she got to start on Sandman. But right, it was soon.
But when Neil Gaiman asks if you want to draw God, you say yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's a riff on that famous line from Ghostbusters. Although I had to make it work. For the benefit of this, I don't know if I was successful. Mainly because how many gods are in Brief Lives anyway?
Not a ton, just a couple.
Yeah.
Just a couple smattering.
So did it work?
It would have worked if I knew Ghostbusters better, because I don't know that quote. I'm sorry.
Winston says it's a Ray when Zool is like, are you a god? And Ray's like, no. And then she blasts them off the rooftop. And,
yeah? I don't remember.
It's a good movie.
I'm sorry, have I lost some nerd cred here?
No, you're fine. So, Brief Lives, MJ, could you give us the stats on this book?
Well, this collects issues 41 through 49, first published between 92 and 93, and the collections first came out in paperback and hardcover in 94. This is one of the bigger of the Sandman graphic novels.
It's true.
With 9 whole issues in it. So it's a thick one. It's a hefty read. Because it's one story and not a collection of shorts, it's very linear.
Yeah.
It's definitely a very popular one, partially.
It's a page-turner, I would say.
Oh, yeah.
Because of its linear nature, it made me want to keep reading. I kept going. I was like, oh, I need to go to sleep, but maybe one more chapter.
You read this in 2 sittings.
I read the first 2 issues one night because I had other work to do.
Yeah.
And then I thought I'd only read 2 more the following night and ended up finishing the whole damn thing, which I haven't done in a long time. And
yeah, I didn't intend to, but I read it in 1 sitting. But this is, I've read it a lot of times.
There's a lot of good stuff in here, and I'm excited to get into it. So let's get started, MJ.
All right.
Let's begin at the beginning.
Okay.
With a nightclub in London.
Well, before that, it starts on Orpheus's island and establishes the caretakers who are,
oh, that's right,
you know, looking after him.
That's
this
important.
Old man named Andros, and he's living there with his son-in-law and his grandson. And Andros is just an old man who loves his life and loves his job, which is to take care of the head of Orpheus,
mm-hmm,
who seems to sing to him every day.
And make sure to drop a flower at the tombstone of one Joanna Constantine.
Every day.
Every day.
Every day, as his father did before him.
Because she found Orpheus's head and took care of him for a while?
Yes.
All right.
She found him after he had been missing for 30 years.
That's one of the stories in Fables and Reflections.
Yes, in Thermidor. Yes, yes, yes.
See, in retrospect, this makes me appreciate Fables and Reflections more because it fleshes it out.
Well, there are a couple things that happen in this book that harken back to those short stories.
Mm-hmm.
And the short stories that are in Fables and Reflections bookend this book because issue 50 comes out, you know, after these issues came out.
That's right.
But is in Fables and Reflections. That was Ramadan.
Oh, man, that drives me nuts. Ramadan should have been in this one. The Orpheus short should have been in this one.
This was already 9 issues long.
Ugh.
I can understand why they decided it didn't fit. But anyway, back to London.
Yeah, the nightclub. And there's Delirium. She's at this like weird kinky BDSM party.
Mm-hmm.
And she's the one person that's going to ruin the night for everybody by having a bad time.
Is it a BDSM party? I couldn't tell. They're just wearing like corsets and garters. And it just looks like
and people are being hung from chains and
like
suspended by their nipples.
It's
and
like a 90s version of the Hellfire Club. With
yeah,
a little bit naughtier. Delirium has to trick the door guy into letting her in.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is that there's a song playing during this sequence.
I couldn't place it. What was it?
It is Tear in Your Hand by Tori Amos.
Oh, come on.
There's actually, in the indicia of this book, there's a little like notation that this is the song that's used.
I didn't find it. Yeah.
That might be the only time that they've like indicated a song that was used. The funny thing about that is that fucking song name checks Neil Gaiman and Sandman.
Of course.
Yeah.
Not that anyone ever accused Neil Gaiman of being self-indulgent, ever.
Well, he was friends with Tori Amos. He still is.
Yeah, everyone knows that.
Yeah.
And I knew that before I even read Sandman.
It's become, you know, history now or whatever. But not all of Delirium is based on Tori, but there's a lot in there.
I can see a lot
of her goofiness.
Mm-hmm.
But not completely. A lot of people think that, oh, he created Delirium after Tori. He created Delirium before he ever knew Tori.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of her that's in it.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's so delightful that that song is in there.
So Delirium's having a bad time, and of course she's in a place of desire. So who pops in but Desire? And they have a nice little convo about where Delirium's at in terms of her state of mind.
Well, it's kind of nice. Desire is just not nice in general. But Delirium realizes while she's in Desire's, you know, temple of their body, of mm-hmm. course, she realizes that she wants to find their lost brother.
Yeah.
This is what's been bugging her. She feels like she seems like she's coming apart at the seams a little bit.
The prodigal member of the Endless Destruction. Now, for those of you who've been listening to our Sandman read-throughs, you know that I've been very keen on discovering who this Destruction guy is. He sounds so awesome and everyone misses him, so he must have been cool, right?
And we've only seen him the once.
Yeah, he was in the wedding of Orpheus and Eurydice. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he was awesome, too. You said he looked like Robert Baratheon. That stuck in my head.
Mm-hmm,
yeah,
mm-hmm.
I liked it. So Delirium wants to find Destruction, and that's pretty much the plot of the book.
Yes. So she asks Desire, help me find our brother. Desire says no. She goes and finds Despair.
That's right.
Desire's twin asks Despair. Despair seems a little ambivalent about this, because Despair loved Destruction, too. But Despair also says no. There's a really cute little flashback sequence that goes back to London's plague year in 1665 that has them interacting. But like I said, Despair says no. So Delirium's like, well, I guess I'll go up in the age ranges, and the next one is Dream. I'll go ask Dream if he'll help me.
Dream doesn't like to help people.
No, he doesn't, but he is less of a shit than he was when we first met him.
That's true, although he is in the throes of a deep, dark depression because somebody just broke up with him.
He is.
And he's making it rain in the Dreaming, so much so that it's flooding everywhere.
And everybody's bitching about it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, he's mourning the loss of his love, and this is this melodramatic thing that he's doing. He's making sure everybody knows that he's so upset.
He's a walking cure album.
Yes, yes. But it's, you know, all this pomp and circumstance to have everybody know how he's feeling.
Mm-hmm. I'm sad. Here's some rain.
Yes.
Nobody understands me. I'm Morpheus. Meh.
Yeah. So,
hey, real quick, who broke up with him?
Well, I guess we don't know yet.
Oh, come on.
Well,
for real?
Remember in Fables and Reflections, Fiddler's Green mentions how he has Dream as a new lady and wanted to get away. I told you that when I was reading these, I had to skip Fables and Reflections because it was out at the bookstore I was buying these at. So I went straight into this, and I thought that I had missed this whole big thing with who Morpheus had been dating.
Yeah, that's how I felt.
Yeah. So I was really upset. I was like, well, I'll get back to that. And I got that before I had finished this and went back. And I was like, it's not even in here. But apparently Gaiman didn't necessarily mean to have that happen. Like, his first draft of that issue had 4 pages of the lady saying, like, we're not working, I'm done. And then he realized that didn't really work in the script. And then he wrote the whole Morpheus telling everyone not to mention her name.
Right.
And then he was like, oh, we're not going to find out who this is for a long time. But we do find out. We do.
So he's sad. Delirium shows up and says, hey, how about it?
And he's kind of mean to her. He's kind of condescending, which is his want. And she remarks to him, and this is the first time out of many, that someone tells Dream that he's changed. Because he apologizes after he's been mean to her, and she starts to cry. And she says that he's never apologized to her. Quote, you just act like you know stuff I don't know that makes everything you do okay.
Well,
Delirium's dialogue in this whole series is fantastic.
Because it seems like gibberish, but every once in a while she drops this like little bon mot or little slice of hard-won wisdom that you wouldn't expect from somebody like her.
Well, as is mentioned later on, there are two sides to every coin, and while Delirium is Delirium, she can also define wisdom as well as Delirium.
She was Delight before she was Delirium.
She was.
And I would say that there is wisdom in Delight.
Yes.
Because you can reflect and appreciate as opposed to take things for granted.
And that's assumedly one of the reasons that she is a big player in this volume, because this volume is all about change.
Mm-hmm.
And she went through the biggest change out of any of the Endless.
Which is ironic because later on in the story, she's trying to think of the word of what happens between now and later.
Mm-hmm.
And Morpheus says, it's changed. She goes, oh, yeah. Huh.
There's a few points in this book where she's talking about change. There's one word balloon where she's just repeating change over and over again.
Also, props to Todd Klein doing that warbly delirium lettering for practically the entire run of this book.
It's done to great effect, though. I love her word balloons.
I wonder if Danny Vozzo actually colored the word balloons or Klein had to do it himself.
I don't know. I wonder.
Yeah.
But they contrast really well with Dream's, you know, cool, squiggly black ones.
So Delirium and Dream have dinner. This is the first and only time I think I've ever seen Dream eat. He doesn't really eat. He just orders food to sit with Delirium.
Mm-hmm.
And she orders two chocolate people that end up having sex.
Mm-hmm.
So odd.
So she asks him to help her find destruction. First, he bops over to Desire and is like, Desire, is this your doing? Since she thought of this when she was with you.
Mm-hmm.
And Desire's like, nope, this one wasn't me. And swears on all the possible things they can swear on.
A whole stack of Bibles.
Yes. So Dream's like, you know what? This sounds like a thing I'll do.
As long as this has nothing to do with that pain in the ass sibling of mine, I'm in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what he doesn't say, and what we don't find out till later, is that he's doing this because he wants to run into his recent ex.
Because where they're going is the waking world,
yes.
Where I presume this ex is hanging out.
Yes.
Is a human.
Mm-hmm.
A mortal.
Mm-hmm.
Or an immortal disguised as a mortal.
Or that.
Because there's a lot of that going on in this book, too.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so apparently on the back of an envelope that Delirium kept for eons, I suppose, she wrote down a list of names of people that knew destruction way back when, who currently live on Earth and who may or may not know where destruction is currently hidden. So they decide to take a road trip, and that's the onus of this entire story. Road buddies.
Yeah.
Yeah, Morpheus and Delirium take to the streets to find people.
Yes. And these immortals that you mentioned, who are disguised as mortals, the first one that we meet is Bernie Capax. And we meet him actually as he meets his death. He's been alive for 15,000 years,
yeah.
Since the days of the cavemen. And he is killed by this random, like, collapsing wall at a construction site.
Completely random. And he says, not yet! And then he wakes up and he feels like he's okay. But then who pops in but Death?
And we get one of the most quintessential quotes from Death that has been put on t-shirts, etc.
Our refrigerator.
Yes. You lived what anybody gets, Bernie. You got a lifetime. No more, no less. It's so good.
She literally put this on our fridge. There's a panel of Death saying that. So I've had that looking at me for 6 years without context.
There are a couple panels from Brief Lives on the
fridge.
Yeah,
I know. I know now.
But they're not spoilers. They're
one of them's kind of a spoiler.
I don't know about that.
Mm.
I don't know about that. Bernie Capax, he was actually the first person on Delirium's list, the lawyer. And the third person on Delirium's list is Etain of the Second Look. And we see her where she suddenly realizes that she smells gas and her house is going to explode.
And she dives through a window before it does in her underwear.
Yes.
And then absconds with her life.
And the cool thing about Etain is that she is 100% a self-portrait of Jill Thompson herself.
Yeah. Yes, that's Jill Thompson skimping around in her underwear for like 4 or 5 pages.
Yes, but she's adorable. That is exactly how she looks.
Do we see Etain again?
I think we see her. No, in later volumes, no. But we see her like really briefly later in this book.
I see.
Just like sketched.
It's just strange to have that one character slip through the fingers of Morpheus and Dream or Morpheus and Delirium and never see her again.
She's not really necessary except in trying to find destruction.
And adds color to what destruction has done, which we find out later on.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And speaking of destruction, we get our first scene with him in the third chapter of this book. And he's trying to paint. Every time we see destruction, he is attempting some form of creation. And each time he's doing this, his erstwhile companion, Barnabas, his dog,
mm-hmm.
is making fun of whatever he's trying to create.
Barnabas is pretty cool.
He has the best dry sense of humor.
As far as talking animals go in the Sandman series, I think Matthew the Raven and Barnabas the dog, my favorites. Also, Destruction has taken the form of a yuppie. Crunchy granola yuppie.
He just shaved his beard.
He's like, far out, man. I'm gonna sculpt, man. He has this wretched sculpture out in the front yard. Barnabas is totally dragging it. He's like, what is that, a lump of whatever with holes in it? It's great.
He's so kind and good-natured, though. Like, expect someone who is the embodiment of destruction.
Like Aries or something.
Yes. Not because he looks so much like an Aries, you mm-hmm. know? But he's not. He is good-natured and kind, and that's...
He wasn't cut out to be an Endless.
Well, this is, again, going back on what he says repeatedly, in that there's two sides to every coin, is that there cannot be destruction without creation. So he is the embodiment of both. So before Morpheus and Dream set out, they go and visit this fellow named Pharamond, who goes by Feral now in Dublin, and he's in charge of transportation. And it turns out he was a member of some bygone pantheon who Morpheus last saw in Babylon, and he recommended to this dude, hey, maybe change your occupation. Travel seems like a good thing to concentrate on, and he's been this embodiment of travel for that long. So because he feels like he owes Dream, he's like, whatever you need, I got you covered. Whatever kind of travel you want, let me know. So he gets them this fancy, awesome car and a driver named Ruby, and they set out on their journey.
They stop at a hotel. Ruby has a little side story where she's trying to relax in the hotel. She lights a cigarette, falls asleep. Cigarette lights the bed on fire, and she dies.
All of this awful shit keeps on happening to the people that they are looking for or are helping them. This is because Destruction has set up sort of like a failsafe that he can see in this big turbulent pool he has in his room, the room of sigils.
But Dream doesn't know that yet.
No, Dream doesn't know. This is why everyone seems to be in danger. This is why Bernie Capac suddenly died. This is why Etain's house blew up.
They say this at the end of the story, but it resonates so completely. If you chase Destruction, you do not come out of it unscathed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like they're literally pursuing Destruction, and in doing so, are wreaking havoc on other people's lives. And it drives home the aloof nature of the Endless. It's like, yes, they are aspects of our waking lives, but they are also, in a way, responsible for them, too.
Now, the second person on the list, the Alderman, we see him at the beginning of the fourth issue,
mm-hmm.
and he is in the process of turning himself into a bear.
He succeeds.
Yes, and he leaves his own shadow to take his place.
Who has no memory of the life that came before.
Yeah, yeah, because he sensed this danger coming.
Yeah.
So he pieces out, he wanders off as a bear.
He couldn't bear the responsibility.
And the fourth person that they are searching for that we have yet to meet is the dancing woman. And we do see her at the end of chapter 4 and then all throughout chapter 5. She is Ishtar. She is the goddess Astarte, the Babylonian goddess of love.
I love that because this took place in the 90s, that nobody could let her name pass for a second without bringing up the fact that that movie stunk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. so good.
But I want to hop back really quick to something. You mentioned how Ruby falls asleep with a cigarette in her hand and burns up. While that's happening, the reason that Morpheus isn't cognizant to save them all is that he's reminiscing. He's having this flashback that we are also seeing of himself and Destruction back in the early 1700s. And this is right before Destruction brought all the family together and was like, hey, I'm leaving. And he talks about why, although Dream doesn't realize it in this flashback. He talks about Newton having discovered a theory that predates Einstein's, you know, theory of relativity and all of that. What ends up becoming the basis of atomic bombs? So Destruction reads this in Newton's works and realizes that once again, in all of these different cycles that he's seen, it's going to be his age soon, and that he doesn't want to deal with it. He doesn't want it to be his responsibility.
And when you say age, you're referring to the era of time, the Industrial Revolution occurred, where war became far more pervasive and deadly.
Yes.
Okay.
And Destruction says, quote, I have been here before. After a while, certain ideas become inevitable. Eon after eon from the dawn days when time was fresh minted, and for how much longer? Are not light and gross bodies intraconvertible? Alas, they are, and from that follows the flames, the big bang, the loud explosions, unquote.
Heady stuff.
Yes.
He doesn't want to be responsible for the destruction of man.
He's just done with it.
Yeah, he would be too. Yeah. I don't blame him.
Yeah. Right before that, though, we see them in a crowd. Dream gets pickpocketed, and Dream decides to set this judgment on this pickpocket that he's going to every night dream that he's on the gallows. And Destruction is like, wasn't that a little harsh? And Dream's like, don't tell me how to do my job. So we get a view right here of how much Dream has changed since those bygone days.
That's another line from Ghostbusters, you know. You do your job, Pencil Neck. Don't tell me how to do mine.
Well, just a little bit later in this book, the same thing happens between Dream and Delirium. Because Delirium is driving the car after Ruby has died.
That's right.
And she's driving it super badly.
Yeah, she's driving really poorly. So much so poorly, in fact, that Morpheus has to bring Matthew in, who used to be a dude, and puts Matthew in charge of guiding Delirium through driving.
But first, she gets pulled over, and this cop is screaming at her, so she decides to have him forever and always think that he has invisible bugs all over him. And here, Dream says, wasn't that a little harsh? And she says the same thing that he had said to Destruction. It's like,
you do your job, Pencil Neck. Don't tell me how to do mine.
Yeah. But yes, after that, Dream brings in Matthew to tell her how to drive. And Matthew is one of my favorite parts of this book. So they all drive to the strip club, which is hilariously called Suffragette City. And we get to know Ishtar a little bit in the interim and one of her fellow strippers named Tiffany. And I really enjoy their interactions. It's this great little B plot for the whole story.
I feel sorry for Tiffany in this book.
Yeah, I do too, but she ends up okay. Ishtar, being a goddess of love, is kind of in hiding at this strip club. This is her form of getting as much worship as she can.
Because when gods receive less tribute, they cease to exist, or they begin to cease to exist.
Yes, and this is her, the only way she can get that little bit of worship to keep on going. But Dream goes and talks to Ishtar, because Ishtar runs off stage as soon as she sees him, because she didn't get along much with Destruction's family when they dated, and they dated way back when. So Dream asks if Ishtar knows maybe where Destruction might be, and also gives her a little bit of a warning, since all this other crazy shit has been happening to their other targets. And that's kind of something that he might not have done in past issues. He actually cares enough to warn her. And she's also the first person to mention that maybe he should seek an oracle to find Destruction.
I find it really interesting that Thompson changes the style of her art for this particular issue. It looks like Sin City. It looks very Frank Miller-esque, especially when the strippers start dancing.
And the colors are really flat and very cool-toned, get that neon light vibe going.
Like that panel especially, the use of shadow and the light and the way it bounces off and the one primary color in the center of it all, it's just like that yellow bastard.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least that's what it looks like to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think that was her and Danny Vatso doing some good shit.
Yeah, some good stuff there.
But after Dream leaves, Ishtar decides to kind of go nuclear and dance like she's never actually allowed herself to dance. And she blows up the club.
Tiffany is left all by herself, distraught. And who pops by but Desire to put a designer jacket around her naked shoulders and say, you'll be all right.
Mm-hmm.
It's very kind for Desire to do, considering that they are not very kind at all.
Yes.
Is Desire changing too as the story progresses, like Dream?
I feel like they do, especially once we get to the end. You know, Desire seems like they regret what has happened, even though the result of the story is what they were trying to do in previous volumes.
Yeah, Desire told Dream at one point in a fit of anger, I'm going to make you kill a member of the family. Like, blood will be on your hands.
Spill family blood.
Yeah, that's it. So we finally get to meet Destruction in all his glory. I mean, we saw him before, but now we get to finally see how that head of his works. He's hanging out with Barnabas. He's making art. He seems pretty happy. There's a cute issue where Dream and Delirium part and go their separate ways. Delirium goes back to her realm. Dream goes back to his. But they reunite at one point because Dream realizes once again he's being selfish with his time and that he did not in fact run into his ex-girlfriend like he wanted to, and he is actually curious to see what his brother Destruction is up to these days and why he left the Endless in the first place.
And he also just, he feels bad that Ruby died. This is one of the things that we can really see him changing, is that he actually cares. He wants to have justice served. He wants to figure out what happened because of her. They go to see Destiny, and Destiny is the third person to tell Morpheus, hey, maybe you should seek an oracle. And Morpheus is like, there are no oracles that can speak of our family. And Destiny says there is an oracle that is of the family.
I had no idea what he was talking about at first.
Well, when he says it, Morpheus just like breaks down. And Delirium has to actually step up and be the collected one.
This is an amazing moment. Because, and this is where Todd Klein comes into it really profoundly, he straightens out Delirium's language. Like, every word she says looks like standard English as it's related in comics.
Mm-hmm.
She's rational. She's sane.
It's here where Dream realizes that the oracle he needs to see is his son, Orpheus, who he swore an oath to never speak to ever again. So he and Delirium make their way to the island that he knows his son is living on with the sect of priests that he established to take care of Orpheus millennia ago. And he goes in to speak with Orpheus while Delirium waits outside. We don't really know what they talk about, but he comes out knowing where Destruction is. And Destruction is living on the island that is directly next to Orpheus's island. Some delightful irony right there. And when they arrive at Destruction's door, they see that he's prepared a fantastic meal for them. And he says, sit down and have dinner with me. We have a lot of stuff to talk about. And so the ensuing issue, which is chapter 8, it's just pretty much the three of them at dinner together, just talking about everything. They're talking about the nature of the endless, the nature of life and afterlife. It is so delightfully philosophical and so eruditely written. I just love it. And there is this one splash page there. I think it's pages like 11 and 12 or 12 and 13. It's this watercolor double page splash that is just the three of them and Barnabas outside with this galaxy of stars above them. And it's probably my favorite splash page ever.
It's here where Destruction explains his rationale. And Dream doesn't exactly buy it. He doesn't take the advice that he gets. He doesn't accept the conclusions that were offered him. He doesn't even put together that Destruction did in fact explain to him in a kind of myriad way, way back in the day, why Destruction ultimately wanted to leave the Endless.
And there was one thing that we find out in this discussion is that Despair was not the first Despair. That she took over the mantle and that Despair at one point was destroyed.
What happened to the other Despair?
We're not told, but we just know that it happened. And they all talk about how it can't have been easy for Despair to have assumed that role with suddenly with all of these siblings to deal with. And
it's a hideous role.
Yes.
You gotta hang out with a bunch of rats.
But I think, like Dream, Despair takes pride in her work. She seems that way when we see her in that plague year little segment.
Yeah, there's that scene with the bubonic plague and her and Destruction are traipsing through the streets of London. And he says that she does good work.
Talking about that whole every side has two coins thing, something that Destruction says in here, quote, our sister defines life just as despair defines hope or desire defines hatred or as destiny defines freedom. And then Dream says, and what do I define by this theory of yours? And Destruction says, reality, perhaps. And one quick note, you notice how the Endless never call her Death? They always say our sister.
Yeah, almost like they're afraid of her.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, she's probably the most powerful of them all.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, well, the three of them, when they're talking about the Endless's existence, they say that they don't even know that Death would be limited by their current existence, that all the rest of them would probably not survive it, but that Death maybe could.
Sidebar, we actually get to see a little bit of that in Books of Magic. When Tim Hunter and that other guy, travel to the end of time, when the universe is packing it up, the last star's gone out a long time ago, and entropy's completely taken hold of the universe, Death is still there.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So at the end of their all-encompassing conversation, Destruction's like, it was nice talking, but I'm getting out of here. And he takes his sigil and he takes his turbulent pool of warning.
And he makes a bindle stick out of it.
Yeah. And he gives Barnabas to Delirium, because he tells Barnabas, you can't follow me where I'm going. And so Barnabas is like, all right, guess I'm taking care of Delirium now. And it's funny, in the little endless storybooks that we see later, Delirium is still hanging out with Barnabas. It's pretty cute.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
He got poochied into the realm of Delirium.
Mm-hmm.
I'm leaving now.
And then we get to the final issue, and we find out the boon that he promised to grant for his son was to kill him.
That's right. Orpheus gave up the goods on where Destruction was if his dad would do him the favor of killing him, wiping him off this mortal coil.
I mean, Orpheus has been wanting to die for a long time. And way back when, Dream was like, your life and your death are your own. Bye.
Why didn't he ask one of the gardeners around? Just like the people who weren't watching him, like the people that, you know, mow the lawn or something. It's like, hey, do me a solid, will you?
Nobody could. Nobody could, because Death swore not to take him. That was how he was able to go down to Hades.
That's right.
Yeah. So the only way that it could be done was Dream apparently putting his hand through his face. And then, like, the very next panel, we see Orpheus's face normal with his head, with eyes rolling back in his head. So
I guess it wasn't permanent what damage Morpheus inflicted on him, but mm-hmm. It was effective because Orpheus is now dead.
And another person tells Dream that he's changed, and it's Orpheus here, right before Morpheus does him the solid of killing him. He says, you have changed since the old days. And then again, Dream says, I doubt it. Every single time people are telling him, he's like, I don't think so.
I'm still hardcore.
Yeah, but he kisses Orpheus on the forehead before he kills him.
He does, and he leaves the blood on his hands, and as he walks through the garden, the blood is dripping from his hands, and it falls onto the ground, and it takes root and blossoms this brand new type of flower.
It's like a page and a half that's totally silent, and it's just beautiful. Like, Jill Thompson and the rest of the art crew,
they slayed it.
Yeah, it's so good.
Mm-hmm.
Despair shows up there on the island.
That's right. She takes one of the flowers.
Mm-hmm. She takes it back to Desire.
That's right. Despair asks Desire, are you happy? Are you happy now that everything happened the way you wanted it? And Desire says, no, but I'm scared. And that's the first time I've ever seen Desire express anything but mustache-twirling villainy.
And we were first told about this whole rule against spilling family blood twice before. The first time at the very end of the Doll's House, when Dream realizes that he's related to Rose Walker because Rose Walker is descended from Desire. And Dream says, was I to take the life of one of our blood with all that would entail? And then in Three Septembers and a January, Desire says, but I'll make him spill family blood. I'll bring the kindly ones down on his blasted head.
So it comes to pass, and it feels like it's foreboding some sort of prophecy, like something's going to happen to the Endless because Morpheus has done the unthinkable. But, you know, Orpheus asked him to do it.
Yeah, there were, like, mitigating circumstances.
Right, so isn't there, like, a mulligan afforded this? Whatever disaster awaits them?
I mean, I guess we'll find out in the volume that's called Dum-Dum-Dum, The Kindly Ones.
So what happens? Dream goes back to the dreaming, he goes up to his palace. Seems a little different. People don't seem to recognize him. In fact, that fairy that was given to him at the end of Midsummer Night's Dream, she's dancing around wearing a pearl necklace she's not supposed to be wearing. And he walks with her for a time and says, oh, that's a pretty necklace you got on. She's all like, what? And Lucian's like, he seems different. Goes up to his boudoir and washes the blood off his hands finally. And then he just sits. And instead of making it rain, he just sits quietly in his throne, overcome with despair.
The contrast of this morning here with his morning at the beginning of the story where it's thunder and rain and everybody's getting wet from all this rain. This is just him by himself and the panels are silent and it's just beautiful.
And he ruminates on the final words that destruction offered him as a gift. And he says, quote, remember that I left. Remember how hard it was for me to leave and that it was not your fault, end quote. And that's Brief Lives. That's book 7, MJ. What'd you think? I mean, I know you love it. You've read this like 20,000 times.
Yeah.
It sucks because I don't have much to provide in these read-throughs other than like, you know, yokel, hey, I like that moment, yuck. Because I don't have time to process it as long as you have.
But you have good perspective because you haven't had as long to process it.
The next book, MJ, what's it called?
The next book is The World's End.
Oh, no.
It's another short story collection.
Oh, no.
But this one has a full framing sequence, so it makes sense.
In
a more linear way.
God, I can't take another collection.
There's one story in there that is drawn by Mike Allred.
Oh.
It's a Prez story.
Prez?
Prez.
As in corndog?
Yes, but the character that she was based on.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm excited now.
Yeah.
All right, I take back what I said.
It's got good shit in there, and it's not going to jump around the way you felt Fables and Reflections did, because, like I said, it's got this framing sequence. It all flows together.
All right, we'll see.
And it introduces a lot of cool stuff.
So the bunch of you who listen to our Sandman read-throughs, you can count on that episode after the next Solicits episode at the beginning of next month.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, MJ, we got to move on to the top 5.
Let's go.
All right, let's do it. All right, MJ, this week you have the 3, I have the 2, and I don't envy you because, like I said earlier in this episode, this week had nothing.
I still say there's good shit.
There's still good shit, but man.
There's none of the dross, man. It's all good stuff.
Oh, okay.
I swear.
Mm-hmm. Well, kick it off. What do you got?
My first pick is The Goddamned, The Virgin Brides, issue 1 of 5. This is a continuation of the series that, when was the last time this came out? Like 2 years ago? It's been a super long time.
It has, and it was called Before the Flood?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this was written by my fave, Jason Aaron, with art by R.M. Guerra, colors by Julia Brusco, with letters and design by Jared K. Fletcher. The whole series, the whole idea of it is that it's like it's kind of gritty retelling of the Book of Genesis. And while the first volume kind of focused on Cain, this is going to switch over to this whole cast of ladies. So I'm very excited to see such a female-heavy story arc in... You know, if you're retelling the Bible, it's going to be very dude-heavy. So I'm very excited to see this perspective.
Yeah, but ladies didn't have it so good in the Bible.
Yeah, it's not fun. I flipped through it, I haven't read it yet, but I can already say there's content warnings abounding.
In the Bible?
In the Bible and in this comic.
Kidding.
Yes.
I'm just kidding.
But yeah, The Goddamned, The Virgin Brides, number 1 of 5, is my first pick of the week. What's your first pick, Jared?
My first pick this week is from Ahoy Comics. I got Billionaire Island number 2. It's been a long time waiting for this book.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's finally here. It's written by Mark Russell, art by Steve Pugh, colors by Chris Chukri, and letters by Rob Steen. It's a farce, MJ. It's a satire about billionaire worship.
Wait, a satire from Mark Russell?
I know. Instagram influencer worship, that kind of crap. If you're a little fed up with wealth worship, this book is quite cathartic. Issue number 2 sees a man infiltrate the island. And here's quick synopsis material. Quote, like an action movie come to life, Trent storms onto Billionaire Island in search of answers, and he's willing to get them any way he can. Meanwhile, Shelley's after answers of her own. But will she regret getting them? The infiltration of Billionaire Island is on? End quote. This book's hilarious. If you're not reading it, you're fucking up. Subscribe now. Go to your store and say, hey, give me Billionaire Island. You won't regret it. That's my first pick. MJ, what's next for you?
Well, my next one, since we didn't have any single issues from Marvel, I got the next best thing. This is from Image. It's called All America Comics, ending with an X, and it's a one-shot, even though it ends in a cliffhanger, so I'm guessing there's more coming.
That's interesting.
So this is written by Joe Casey, who is the co-creator of the character America Chavez from Marvel. This is him taking that character, kind of rubbing the serial numbers off, and telling more of the stories that he wanted to tell with her. It's
a lot of creators have done this.
But this is so obviously Marvel. Like, there's obviously the Avengers in there. There's a female Thor in there who talks about being worthy of her hammer. Very slightly filed off those serial numbers. But like I said, written by Joe Casey, art by Dustin Nguyen, colors by Brad Simpson, designed by Sonia Harris, letters by Russ Wooten. It's really fun. The art's awesome because we haven't seen sort of more pencil-y art from Dustin Nguyen in a long time. And I just like seeing more America, whether her last name is Vasquez or Chavez. I recommend it. What's your next pick this week?
Also from Image Comics, a graphic novel, which is technically the series premiere of Firepower.
Yeah.
That book we've been talking about a lot on this podcast got pushed back because of COVID. Mm-hmm. It was supposed to debut for Free Comic Book Day. Mm-hmm. Didn't. Well, here it is. But the first issue is free if you're looking for it at a comic book store, so you can get the graphic novel and the first issue for absolutely free, like it was planned, just, you know, a couple months late.
When the series actually starts, though, issues 1 and 2 come out on the same day. I find that so frustrating.
Yeah, what are you going to do? That's Kirkman, Firepower, written by Kirkman, art by Chris Somney, colored by Matt Wilson, and letters by Russ Wooten. It's about a kid who develops the power of wielding fire, which gives him more power.
Fireball!
It's a martial arts story written by a bunch of white guys. But the technique is quite good, and Chris Somney doing an ongoing series is something that you have to celebrate.
Somney and Wilson's art together is, it's always so good.
You're not going to believe how good this book actually looks until you read it. The story is a little rote. When you read Firepower, Prelude, OGN, which I'm recommending this week, you're going to come across a couple of tropes that may seem a bit tired, but the art alone is the reason why you want to pick this up. Check it out. Firepower, Prelude, graphic novel is out today. From Image Comics. MJ, what's next for you?
My last pick for the week is also a graphic novel, a collection. This is from Marvel. This is one of the few they put out this week. This is Excalibur Volume 1. Excalibur is one of my faves of this new flock of X-Men books. And this one is written by our pal Teeny Howard with art by Marcus Toe, colors by Eric Arseniega, and letters by VC's Corey Pettit. It stars Betsy Braddock back in her own body, thankfully, still with purple hair, and she takes over the mantle of Captain Britain up in here. And this is dealing with lots of magic, lots of Arthurian lore, and also Apocalypse, and also Gambit and Rogue in it. So is Jubilee. It's great. I highly recommend it.
I want to check this out, largely because I've been sitting on a lot of these Dawn of X books, because I'm waiting for trades. Excalibur is written by Teeny, a writer that I hold in high esteem. I'm excited to check this out.
She really excels at this whole intersection between mutantdom and magic and Arthurian legend. It's great. $17.99 for the book it collects, issues 1 through 6. Go get it.
Yeah. And that wraps up our top 5 most anticipated issues of the week. All right, folks, we've been answering your questions for a dang change. If you have questions for Casual Wednesdays, comic-related, of course, shoot them our way at info@doomrocket.com. That's our email address. info, I-N-F-O, at doomrocket.com. And we'll read them here and answer them to the best of our ability, which we will do right now. Tom Galloway reached out to Casual Wednesdays and asked, what characters who aren't do you think should be redheads?
He also says, note, the main one I could think of who did go ginger would be Black Widow, who went from black hair to red in Spider-Man number 86.
That's a ridiculous question, Tom. Thank you so much.
I think it's because he knows I have that redhead sketchbook. Because a cool thing to do when you have a sketchbook for people to draw in at cons is to have it be kind of open-ended. So you can give it to the artist and be like, hey, just something on this vague subject. And then they can kind of do what they want and go a little nuts. And it gets you cool stuff. And having it be redheads means they're kind of inclined to use red in it as well as just pencils and ink.
Really puts you on the spot when you have to think about it, though. What character would benefit from becoming a redhead?
All of them. Redhead characters are great.
Lana Lang's a redhead, and I feel like she should remain a redhead. Lois Lane's a brunette, and I feel like she should remain a brunette.
But Lois Lane's hair was kind of auburnish in the early 90s. We've talked about this.
That's true. That's true.
It went from raven hair to kind of a reddish brown.
And then back to black, and then, yeah. That's just because creators don't give a shit.
And then, of course, Amy Adams played her, and Amy Adams has the hair like mine.
Blasphemous red locks. I know, I remember.
I'm trying to think of the ones that are redheads. There's Matt Murdock.
I got one. Jason Todd.
He's gone back and forth.
Yeah, he had red hair and he dyed it black to emulate Dick. And then just had black hair post-crisis. But then Grant Morrison rolled around and gave him red hair again. So just give Jason Todd red hair permanently. Boom, make that happen.
It's like black with a white stripe in it now, right?
I don't know. I don't read that goddamn book.
I sure don't either.
Okay, MJ, so who do you think? Red hair.
Peter Parker.
Peter Parker is a redhead.
Just the way that he's always kind of an outsider. I think having him be a redhead on top of that, maybe it might be too much, actually. But I think it would fit his character.
Yeah, we tend to push the redheads out to the periphery of society.
Poor gingers.
That's how it should be.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding.
Maybe I'll dye my hair black.
Oh, no.
Dick Grayson could be a redhead.
No, that's blasphemy.
He could. It would work. Wolverine could be a redhead.
Yes, that sounds great. Let's make Wolverine a redhead. Because why not? He's surly. Most redheads are surly.
Except instead of having his hair be like, you know, the spiky kind of curly. Almost ears, it would be curls. It would be curls like Miles O'Brien on Star Trek.
And that would explain the chip on his shoulder.
Yes.
Yeah. Curly red hair.
Yes.
We're going to get some mean emails for this. Thanks for the question, Tom. If you have questions that you want answered from Casual Wednesdays, again, that email address is info@doomrocket.com. Now, MJ, here we are in the back matter at last. Don't have much to talk about. But I did want to tease to our listeners what's to come from Casual Wednesdays for the next 3 weeks.
Oh, I know what this is.
I know you know that I know that you know.
Well, I'm glad you know that I know because I know that you know.
All right, that's enough of that. So next week, Casual Wednesdays begins, I guess, what's looking like an annual tradition.
Yes, the second annual, I guess.
Mm-hmm. What we did last year was DC versus Marvel and the amalgams that came from it, and they proved to be quite popular. And we teased that we would do the second round of amalgam episodes.
And it took Jared this long to convince me to do them.
Yes, it took almost an entire full year to convince MJ that we were going to tackle, dun-dun-dun, next week, All Access, the next DC versus Marvel crossover featuring Access, that character you love from said crossover. He gets his own spinoff miniseries. I flipped through it today. It's going to be a rocky road, MJ. I can't promise you anything great. But then after that, we do the second wave of amalgam titles, and some of those are even better than the ones that came before.
I remember there was one or two from the second wave that I read when we were doing the first ones, and they were pretty okay.
Lobo the Duck? Iron Lantern? Yeah, it's going to be pretty fun. So, next week, All Access. The week after that, The Amalgam Age of Comics, Part 3. And then after that, The Amalgam Age of Comics, Part 4, believe it.
That's four hours of our life.
Hey, those episodes did gangbusters. There's no reason why we can't do it again. Give the people what they want. That's what I say.
All right.
All right. And And that's it. That's all the time we have for this week's Casual Wednesdays. Need more of this dweeby little podcast in your life? Check out our episode archive over on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or any good podcatcher. Rate, follow, subscribe, whatever you want to do. Just tell us how we're doing, or click Casual Wednesdays over on DoomRocket.com. New episodes every week. And while you're at it, look us up on Twitter at @CashWedsPodcast. I'm at @JaredJones_MJ. Where can they find you?
At @MollyJane_K.
So until the day DC and Marvel launch the amalgam title, Howard the Drunk, I remain Jared. That's MJ over there. And from all of us here at DoomRocket.com, have a great new comic book day. It would be Howard the Duck, Tony Stark, and quick, give me a DC character.
Captain Carrot?
Yes, Captain Carrot, who is drunk.
Okay.
All right.